This evening, we have a great guest, somebody who really knows the inside workings of the Obama press operation, because he's the deputy press secretary. Earlier in the semester, we heard from Bill Burton. Okay. And it's good to hear from both of you all.
Hopefully we won't contradict each other too much.
I don't think so. And we'll see the differences in the kinds of things that you all do.
Great.
Joshua Earnest is our guest, and he's worked in a lot of different places in Washington. So can you tell us about your background and how you got into the communications business?
Yeah. It's a good question. As I was preparing to graduate from college a while ago now, I didn't have a job, and I went to go see my advisor and said, I'm interested in politics, but I don't really have a job lined up for the summer and trying to figure out what I'm going to do in real life. And he suggested that I go volunteer in a campaign. And
what year was it?
This was 1997.
And what was the college?
I went to school at Rice University.
Uh-huh.
Down in Houston. And one of the professors who's on faculty was actually plotting a run for mayor at the time. There's an open seat. They have off-year elections there, so it was 1997. And I went in during his office hours and mustered up the courage to ask him for a job. And he said, well, we haven't even started the campaign yet. As soon as I hire a campaign manager, I'll have him give you a call. And, of course, they had never called. Mm-hmm. But I persisted and read that he had hired a campaign manager and went in and interviewed with him. And he said, you sound great. We would love to have you on the team. Only catch is we can't afford to pay you. So I lined up a couple other jobs at night and volunteered during the day and sort of got in on the ground floor of this campaign. And after about 6 weeks or so, they must have thought I was doing a pretty good job, because the campaign manager came to me and said, if you will quit all your other jobs, then we will pay you to work here and basically sell your life to work for us 24 hours a day. And that's what I did, but it was a great way to get started. And eventually, he went on to win. He was the first African-American who was elected mayor of the city of Houston. At the time, Houston was the largest city in the country that never had a minority mayor. So his name was Lee Brown. He had been the police chief in Houston. When he got hired in 1982, the Ku Klux Klan actually held a rally on the steps of the courthouse to protest his hiring. And then 15 years later, he was elected mayor of the city. So it was a very interesting campaign to work on, and it was a historic campaign. And was a great way to get involved in politics. There's an old expression about all politics being local, mm-hmm. and I think there was a benefit to working on a mayoral campaign for my first job, because it was an opportunity to, you do get a sense of, we probably got more letters about people protesting the speed bumps being included in their neighborhood streets than we did about any other issue that we dealt with.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of a great way to get a sense of what a voter's perspective is on a campaign, and sort of about the issues that they care about, but also sort of how they see politics. And it's a good reminder, at least for me, as even though, you know, even now working at the White House on sort of basically a global level, that people really are singularly focused on how is a particular policy, or how is a particular issue, or how is a particular viewpoint going to affect their day-to-day life. It was a good lesson to learn very early on.
Uh-huh.
But went on from there and worked for a consulting firm in Texas for a few years before I moved to D.C. in 2001.
What kind of consulting firm was it?
It was a campaign consulting firm that primarily did opposition research. So this is sort of in the early days of the Internet. But this was we spent a lot of time sort of researching the background of the candidates that we worked for and the background of the candidates that our client was running against, to basically, you know, in large part compare public records, and to sort of equip our campaign with the information that we needed to have a public debate about the issues. So this is looking, you know, closely at legislative voting records, looking closely at the executive records that some of our clients had, they held executive positions either at statewide offices or others, and that also was a good foundation for getting into politics. That at the end of the day, sort of, that if you're gonna, that politics is about making a case for yourself, about why your policy is right, about why your policy will have the best interest or has in mind the interests of voters. And so being able to marshal the facts to support that case is, in some ways, the root of politics. And is, you know, is sort of the foundation for the kind of debate that we frankly have at the White House on a daily basis, that being able to marshal these facts in a way that will make the case about why the policies that President Obama is advocating are in the best interest of viewers out there. So shortly after moving to D.C., after doing that for a few years, that I got my first job in political communications as the communications director for Congressman Marion Barry from Arkansas. So a conservative Democrat from a pretty strongly Democratic congressional district. He'd been in Congress for three or four terms when I worked for him. And got a very different lesson in all politics being local. He was running for re-election in 2002 and actually moved to Arkansas. I had an apartment in Jonesboro, Arkansas, for about 4 months in 2002 and helped run his re-election campaign. His congressional district spanned is probably 29 or 30 different counties. And he was very dedicated to traveling his district and going to all sorts of small towns and farm shops and county fairgrounds to meet with his constituents, to talk about the issues that they cared about, and to make the case about why it was important or why the things that he was working on in Congress was important to them. And so it's obviously his constituents were a lot different than the constituents that I met when I was working for the guy who was running for mayor of the city of Houston, the fourth largest city in the country, to then spend a lot of time in cities like Jonesboro, which was actually the largest city in his congressional district. But it was also a good sort of initiation into understanding what it is that voters were caring about and how you could make sort of the day-to-day work of Congress relevant to the people who are in that congressional district to make the case for why Congressman Barry should be reelected.
Now, have you found that that you have worked with members of Congress that's been important for you guys on health care, to work with members of Congress, to work with their communications staff, to talk about that very issue of how you make health care bill that's now passed relevant to their constituents?
Well, we have talked about that quite a bit, because one of the principal challenges of dealing with the health care reform debate over the last year has been that it's only recently, people sort of forget, it's only recently that we've actually had a health care bill. It would be frustrating sometimes even to watch the daily briefing with Press Secretary Robert Gibbs at the White House, that people would say, but Robert, why can't you just even articulate what's in the bill? Well, the truth of the matter is, until the very end, there wasn't actually a bill. And the truth is, what the House voted on at the very end was to change the bill that they were getting ready to pass. So when people talk about the fact that there were all sorts of different competing proposals, and there was a bill that was passed through the Senate, which was different than the bill that was passed through the House, which differed in some ways from the preferences of the president, so that there are lots of different proposals and agendas and ideas for what should be included. But this very root question of what's in the bill is not something that we'd been able to answer until really just two or three weeks ago, until it was passed at the very end. So when the president talks a lot about how the next several weeks and months will be an opportunity to communicate with the American people about what's in the health care bill, the reason for that is not because we haven't had a robust debate about what should be in the bill. We have had a very robust debate. In fact, some people are sick of it, including some reporters who've been covering this for a year. But what we can have a conversation about is what's actually included and what are the things that are going to lower costs for middle-class families all across the country. What does it mean for there to be tax cuts for small businesses so that they can more easily afford health care benefits for their employees? What does it mean for us to close the donut hole for seniors? What does it mean for us to increase efficiencies in the Medicare system? What does it mean for us to impose the kinds of insurance reforms that will protect patients from being victimized by their insurance companies, from being discriminated against for getting sick or for having a pre-existing condition? For ensuring that kids can have access to health care. We've been debating the pros and cons of these issues and the impact this will have on the larger system for, I mean, not just the last year, but for, frankly, for decades before that. But it's only in the last two or three weeks we've been able to have this conversation in the context of one specific proposal that the House has passed, the Senate has passed, and that the President signed into law. So I think that's why this is so critical, you know, these next few weeks and months as we sort of continue to talk about the health care bill.
One thing that didn't seem that you all did was to focus on, because you couldn't focus on exactly what the legislation, what the proposals themselves were, mm-hmm. is focusing on the problems mm-hmm. and saying, there's six problems here, or seven or whatever, mm-hmm. that we're dealing with, and these are the nature of the problems. And mm-hmm. you know, there's some alternatives here we're dealing with, but we want alternatives that are going to deal with medical bankruptcy. And then bring in, you know, you and I have talked about this, uh-huh. bring in a whole string of people mm-hmm. into the White House who are examples of what happens when you have to declare medical bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And why, in a way, you all lost control of the debate mm-hmm. over the summer, mm-hmm. that the opposition came in and defined what the bill was about, that's right. It was a raid on the Treasury. Mm-hmm. And so now, in a sense, what you have to do is try to go back with the eraser and say, look, this isn't a raid on the Treasury. You know, it's saving people money because people don't have to go, you won't be going to the emergency room. That's right. and it's going to help middle class families. Mm-hmm. Was there, during that whole time, was there a sense that somehow you were, the opposition had gotten in and gotten the best of you?
Well, I think there was this sense that we needed to, I don't think that even to this day, the Republicans who are going out there and saying that they want to repeal this bill, even they are acknowledging that some reforms to the system
right.
are needed.
Yeah.
So I don't think we were ever in a position where we lost the debate about whether the system should be changed. We lost, I would say that we weren't necessarily as effective as we could have been looking back in making it clear why the solutions that the president was supporting would actually address the problems that people have. That we allowed the impact of the proposed solutions to get hijacked by the opposition,
yeah.
who rather than sort of focusing on the importance and frankly the cost reduction benefits of covering everybody, to making it a case about a $1 trillion health care bill or a government takeover of health care. I mean, and in some cases, we saw that the opposition became pretty fast and loose with the facts, to be honest with you.
Right. Uh-huh.
But we were in a position in which we didn't do as good a job as we could have in defining what the impact of those solutions would be for people, right? Frankly, making the case in a crystal clear terms, not necessarily why we need reform. I think we were pretty successful on that front, but not as successful in talking about why the specific proposals that the president has laid out are going to address the problems that we've identified
right.
and that we frankly all agree that we have.
Uh-huh.
And I think the reason for that is what I mentioned earlier, which is that there wasn't necessarily one specific proposal, right? That the president was in a position where he said, you know, the House is working on a set of proposals to address these issues. The Senate is working on a set of proposals to address these issues. The president brought some of his own ideas to the table. But it was hard to have a discussion about the one idea when there are so many ideas floating around out there. And that's why, you know, again, that's why the passage of this legislation and continuing to talk about it publicly over the next few weeks and months is so important, because we do have a specific proposal and one specific solution, and we will have an opportunity to make the case about why these are the kinds of things uh-huh. that will address the problems that we all agree we have.
One of the facts about White House life is that the engine seems to be, the ship is always moving forward. Mm-hmm. And that it's difficult to look backwards.
No doubt about that.
And on health care, how did you do that? At what point did you recognize that the opposition was getting traction that you all didn't want them to have, and that you were going to need to do some changing of course? How do you do that in a White House that's always moving forward?
Well, the thing that I give the president a ton of credit for is that he used that forward momentum to get this thing done. Mm-hmm. That there were a lot of times when it would have been easy to say, to just basically, you know, pull the ejector switch
yeah.
and just bail out of this debate, pass something small and, you know, and consider it done and say we got historic health care done, whether it was actually historic or not. But the president didn't give up, even after this tough, you know, this
yeah.
what everybody described as a tough patch in August. And I say everybody described it that way because I agree with you. It was a tough patch. But it was only 6 weeks or so after that the House actually passed legislation to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only a couple months after that the Senate passed legislation on Christmas Eve. What the president had talked about during the campaign was his commitment to signing health care reform legislation by the end of his first year in office. And the truth of the matter is, he was on track to accomplish that promise, right? That we were basically engaged in this pretty aggressive effort to marry up those two bills shortly after the first of the year, and to pass, you know, basically a conference, a version of the bill that uh-huh. both passed the House and the Senate. Now, obviously, the process changed a lot when Scott Brown was elected the next senator from Massachusetts, mm-hmm. And that did create a circumstance where the process, I think, did get close to stopping. That there were a lot of people in the House, or certainly on both sides of Capitol Hill, who were sort of scratching their heads, wondering how do we move forward from here. And I think it's a testament to the president's tenacity that he kept the process moving forward, and he worked closely with Speaker Pelosi and Leader Reid, who obviously deserve a ton of credit as well, in sort of keeping this process moving forward and getting it done. And I think, in hindsight, a couple of things I think were key to that. One is the Blair House Summit on health care, where uh-huh. the president had this seven-hour-long discussion with you know, Democrats and Republicans from the House and the Senate to talk about what the package should look like. It undercut all of the Republican arguments about this being a backroom deal, about the president not listening to input from Republicans in this process, because he was sort of doing it all in front of the television cameras, and he had a good explanation for why he was supporting the kinds of things that he wanted to see included in the legislation. And I do think that was an important signal to the American people that you had the president out there willing to defend his own ideas about what was going to be included in here. And it frankly was an important signal to members of Congress uh-huh. that the president was going to be front and center in making the case for this. And I think that changed the dynamics of the debate in a significant way that eventually led to its passage.
One of the factors that might have been involved in your all deciding to do that was, of course, the commitment during the campaign to be transparent and to have mm-hmm. the debate on C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. And C-SPAN certainly was ready to carry debate, and they wanted to carry the debate.
Mm-hmm.
Why did it take as long as it did to put it out on C-SPAN, and what were you thinking about when you were laying out that session? Mm-hmm. How did you see it as unfolding, and then how did it actually unfold?
Well, I mean, the way that we wanted to, I think it unfolded in a lot in the way that we expected. The one thing that I think that we were hoping to be able to do was to foster the kind of environment where there would be a pretty free exchange of ideas, where people would be able to get away from the talking points and not just sort of, not have a de facto committee hearing in which everybody had prepared statements where they would read them. I'm not sure that we quite lived up to those expectations in mm-hmm. terms of our desire to do that, because I think there was a lot of there were a lot of prepared remarks that were carried right. in that room that were then
yeah.
just read. But I do think that it was important for the people who did participate in that thing, in that meeting, to feel like they were heard. Mm-hmm. I mean, after almost every person spoke, the president, or in most cases it was the president, who offered a pretty direct, thoughtful response to both Democrats and Republicans when they spoke. So I think it was a little more scripted than we would have liked, but scripted in that people were able to sort of come in with a prepared set of talking points that they'd been delivered. But I do think that it was a thoughtful exchange of ideas.
Right.
I do think that people felt like they were heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a pretty critical turning point in the whole thing.
Uh-huh. Was the second one the session in Baltimore?
I think that was an important moment too.
Uh-huh.
I think in some ways, the president looked pretty good at that meeting. That
uh-huh.
he was somebody who had a command of the facts, and he was somebody who was willing to stand up for what he believed in. I mean, almost literally, he was willing to stand up in front of the opposition and hold his ground. And I think there were a lot of people at that point in time who were doubting the president's resolve. And to take a risk, to have a debate in front of a room full of Republicans, live on television, I think impressed people, not because they doubted that he knew what he was talking about, or they doubted his ability to make to debate the issues in front of an audience. He demonstrated that in lots of places. But the fact that he was willing to do that, the fact that he was willing to take on his critics head on, you know, and I think that there were a lot of, frankly, a lot of Democrats who were emboldened by that, who said, well, you know, if the president's willing to stand up there and fight this hard to get it done, then I should be too. And I think that's why that moment was so important.
What role does the president himself have in making decisions about his communications? What kinds of things would he be involved in making decisions about what he's going to do, how he's going to present something?
Sure. The thing that allowed the president to really burst on the national scene was the speech that he gave at the Democratic Convention in 2004. So his speech writing and speech making abilities are well known. And I think that is certainly one very important way that he influences the communications process, because he is somebody who does spend a lot of time thinking about and writing down what it is that he wants to say. You know, we obviously have a team of very talented speechwriters who assist him greatly in that process, but particularly when it's something that is that he knows is going to get a lot of attention, or if it's something that he hasn't talked about before in the context of sort of a rollout of a new thing, the president will spend a lot of time thinking about and writing down how it is that he wants to present these issues to the public. And so that is obviously a very significant way in which he personally influences very directly how his message is delivered in the context of writing his own speeches.
Does he talk about policy in terms of communications as well? If he thinks that it's going to be difficult to explain something, that perhaps the policy isn't sufficiently mature, so that it becomes part of the political calculus, the policy calculus, so that the communications works together, that all three of them are important in the policymaking process.
They are all important in the policymaking process. I would say that I think in the mind of this president that the policy does come first, that he genuinely is in a position where he feels like we need to make the right decision about a particular policy area based on the merits of the policy. Once we've figured out the right decision, I think that he is confident enough in his own abilities to explain why he made that decision, and is confident, frankly, in the American people to evaluate that decision on its merits as well. It doesn't mean he is naive enough to think that everybody's going to agree with him after he's made the decision, but I do think that he has a pretty innate belief in the American people that if you make the right decision for the right reasons, that you'll get the benefit of the doubt even among the people, among some of the people who don't agree with your final decision. I think that's the reason, frankly, that a lot of Republicans and independents supported him during the campaign, that it's much about the process of making these decisions for the right reasons as it is for what those actual decisions are.
But it seems that once you moved into the governing phase, that it's been different, that it's been difficult to go into a room and get people, Republicans, who have strong policy views on health care, for example, that they haven't given him the same kind of benefit in listening to him.
No doubt about that. No doubt about that. I mean, it's clear, it is crystal clear to any impartial observer that that Republicans on Capitol Hill entered 2009 with a very specific political strategy to oppose the President of the United States on everything that he did. That there's no argument about that. The truth of the matter is, there's probably no argument about the degree of success that they've had, right? That they've been very successful in obstructing the President's agenda and blocking a lot of things from getting done, and in doing so, they have lowered the approval rating of the President and the Democrats in Congress, and frankly won a couple of elections that originally seemed in doubt. Scott Brown's the best example. So if I worked for John Boehner or Mitch McConnell, I wouldn't suggest that they do anything different in terms of the political calculus that they're making, because obstructing the President got them a Senate seat in Massachusetts that they hadn't held in generations. So they've engaged in a political strategy that, evaluating it from a political perspective, has been pretty successful for them. Now, it hasn't been a, it certainly hasn't helped their approval rating.
Right.
I mean, for all of the criticism that Democrats in Congress take, all the polls that I've seen, you actually see that Democrats in Congress are actually rated higher than Republicans in Congress. And that on issue after issue, despite all the criticism of Washington, D.C., despite all of the criticism of the way that Democrats have managed the majority in Congress, from, frankly, principally from Republicans, they do have a higher approval rating on issue after issue than the Republican leadership. So this is a political strategy that has scored them some important victories, but it hasn't been without its costs. And so, you know, I think that the president has been disappointed in that, that he had hoped that he would be able to come to Washington, D.C. and find some willing partners among Republicans. I don't think all hope is lost. The president is, you know, the president made a promise in the State of the Union, for example, to meet on a monthly basis with the bipartisan, bicameral leadership in the Congress, and that's something that he will continue to do, and it's going to do later this month. The president is still seeking to work with folks like Senator Corker from Tennessee and Senator Shelby from Alabama on financial regulatory reform. The president is still talking to folks like Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina about energy legislation, about the process of trying to close Guantanamo Bay, the prison at Guantanamo Bay. So the president is going to continue to reach out to Republicans and try to engage them. But, you know, I mean, there's no question that that they've engaged in a strategy of obstructing the president that has, in some ways, been pretty successful.
Mm-hmm. But that's kind of a short run.
No doubt about that. That's it's a risk.
Because you have to show that you're that you've got some ideas of what you're going to do.
You do.
And how you're going to lead
if you
were to take over.
Right. And I do think that voters, at the end of the day, do want to see that, regardless of what the final decision. I mean, in some ways, I guess I agree with the president here, that in some ways, people who don't live in Washington, D.C., want to see their elected representatives figuring out a way to work together to get something done. That at the end of the day, they're willing to see Congress do some things that they don't agree with 100%, as long as they see Congress making an effort, a constructive effort, to address the kinds of challenges that people all across this country are facing. And I think that's frankly why we've seen a little bump among Democratic members of Congress after this health care reform bill has passed. That people, whether they agree with that bill or not, and I still do think that that you know, after a few months of talking about this, more people are going to view that bill in a favorable light. But that when they see Congress getting things done that will actually make a difference in their lives in a positive way, that improves their viewpoint, their sort of view of Congress doing their job.
One of the institutions that is crucial to the president's success is the news media. The news media is an important link mm-hmm. between the public and government officials.
Absolutely.
And so I'd like to explore that somewhat.
Okay.
What views you all work on of what the role of the press is
sure.
in a democratic society.
Sure.
And how your views of the press have changed from the campaign mm-hmm. To governing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting time to think about and talk about and work with the media at the White House, because the media landscape is changing so quickly that it's, that television news and print news and radio news is a lot different than it used to be. I think there are still incredibly talented, incredibly smart, incredibly dedicated people who are writing for those newspapers, who are talking about this administration on the radio and on television. But there's no question that business is changing. There are questions about how that business is going to continue to make money. And there are questions about whether that business has the same influence that it once did because of the other outlets that people can turn to. The truth of the matter is, anybody with a political blog can apply for a credential to come to the White House to attend the daily briefing and can sit, you know, all but stand right next to Chuck Todd as he's asking a question of Robert Gibbs and ask a follow-up question. And that is a pretty significant leveling of the playing field, if you will. That that to think that a sort of a, you know, a quote-unquote regular person off the street would have almost the same access to the administration as the chief White House correspondent for a major television network.
But the reality is that when you break down the briefing and the amount of time that's spent, it's about 75% of the time, or let's say between 70-75% of the time is spent on the first two rows. Mm-hmm. And the first two rows are the five television, the Wires, the New York Times, the Washington Post. So the idea that a blogger, you know, from Moline's going to come in there and get a question is pretty unlikely, unless they go into, you know,
well, unless they come back
after
to me,
the
right?
briefing. Yeah, sorry.
That's true. That's true. I think maybe somebody needs to go and explain to these prominent media outlets that they can't make up their influence by asking more questions. That may be true, but I do think that that it's not uncommon for people that don't have a very large audience to get a question during the briefing. Maybe not the same person each time, but. Mm-hmm. But if you sort of go back and think about who some of the legendary White House reporters were when they started their career, somebody like Helen Thomas, who was a real trailblazer and was rightfully and continues to be rightfully respected and lauded for mm-hmm. her dedication to covering this administration, for her to basically, you know, be sitting in sitting in the same row or at least sitting in the same room, you know, as somebody who has a website that they started last week. That purports to cover politics, I think that reflects a pretty significant change in the media landscape. And so that's obviously a challenge for news organizations to deal with in terms of trying to find new ways to reach people and new ways to sort of assert their relevance. Mm-hmm. But it also poses significant challenges for our operation as well. And the truth of the matter is, when you're obviously a more keen observer of what previous administrations did. But when, if you're John F. Kennedy's press secretary, you basically have to deal with three television networks,
Mostly two, because ABC wasn't much there.
Yeah, mostly two television networks. Maybe a couple of radio networks, and then six or eight influential political reporters. And they would do one report a day, and maybe sometime on the weekend. Now, you've got at least six television networks that have some influence. Three or four wire services, depending on whether you can AFP or not. And then obviously, almost an unlimited number of bloggers, all of whom are reporting several times a day, right? That if you're dealing with a television reporter, they have to go out there every hour on the hour to say something about what's happening at the White House that day. They can't just go and say the same thing every time, so there's got to be more that's happening. You have wire service reporters and even newspaper reporters now that are updating blogs and things regularly. Uh-huh. So there really is sort of this, there's been this, multiplication, a rapid expansion in the volume of things that uh-huh. are happening and the way that stuff is reported and consumed is entirely different than it was we even do make some comparisons to Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. Fox News was in its infancy then. CNN was sort of
right.
around.
Yeah.
But now that these are, obviously very robust, opinion-shaping news organizations, mm-hmm. And that so doing this job now is very, very different than it was even 15 years ago.
Uh-huh. But mainstream media, say the, mm-hmm. the Washington Post, the New York Times, the L.A. Times, AP, Reuters, mm-hmm. They're crucial for the news that the bloggers have.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you can't just disregard them.
Not at all. Not at all. There's a reason they sit in the first two rows, right?
Yeah, right.
but they do continue to be critical to the public's perception of the way that the president is doing his job and what it is that the president stands for and is working on.
Mm-hmm.
So we obviously do spend a lot of time working with them on their stories, and that's what makes it challenging when you know, again, the New York Times continues to assert a lot of influence over the public's perception of the president. But rather than writing two or three stories a week about what's happening at the White House, you have four or five New York Times reporters writing two or three things a day about what's happening at the White House.
Uh-huh.
And so if that's an outlet that you're trying to influence, or at least an outlet that you're trying to, you know, to influence, or at least give them the full story or a full view of what it is that you're working on, when they're working on that much stuff, it poses a pretty significant challenge.
Yeah. Do you have a do you have somebody that kind of serves as a traffic cop that knows what all the different things are? Like, say, in the Clinton administration, the Washington Post had just a very large number of mm-hmm. people that mm-hmm. were at the same time looking for policy stories. You know, there would be people at the White House working on financial ones. There would be people working on things that related just directly to the president. So there were a lot of different things. And one of the reporters from the Washington Post, Ann Devroy, mm-hmm. in a sense served as something of a traffic cop because she knew what everybody was doing. Mm-hmm. And so then she dealt with both George Stephanopoulos and with Mike McCurry mm-hmm. On what was happening and how important what kinds of stories were.
Yeah.
So do you have any kind of operation that tries to bring together all of what the New York Times is trying to do, like whether David Sanger is dealing with Iran, with people in the NSC, mm-hmm. and Peter Baker is doing a piece on influence of past presidents, and mm-hmm. you know, Cheryl Stolberg is doing something, you know, might deal with the First Lady's operation as well as the mm-hmm. West Wing.
Yeah.
So where do you bring all the information together of all the different kinds of stories that are out there from different news organizations? Where does that come together?
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes together in a couple of different ways. You know, we do two daily meetings with our communication staff, one first thing in the morning and one at night, where people have the opportunity to raise issues or raise concerns to sort of a higher level to ensure that, you know, a story is getting addressed in the proper way, that they're getting the kind of feedback that they need from the machinery of the White House to get answers to some of the policy questions that come up. But the other way that we organize it is typically a little bit different than by news outlet. We actually organize it principally by issue area, that we have one person in our office who's responsible, just for one example, for energy policy, so that any story or any reporter at any news outlet that's working on an energy story will go talk to him for their story, so that we can be sure that that story is being handled appropriately by somebody who has some experience and knowledge of the issue, but also that it makes sense that a lot of these, that as these stories happen, that multiple outlets will cover the same story, right? So that if we're making a policy announcement about some energy specific
yeah.
issue, that, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the AP, all the television networks will all do a story on it. So we want to make sure that one person is handling that story, so that the same story is being told to all those different outlets. And again, this is particularly important when you have a pretty significant expansion in the number of outlets who are covering the White House. So that the same thing that appears on CNN television is the same thing that appears on CNN.com, is the same thing that appears on Politico.com, that all these sort of disparate outlets are all getting the same story. And we do that by running that story through the same person in our operation, so that everybody's sort of getting the same thing.
But won't they look for different angles?
They will.
Like Politico, for example, is going to look for the political angle. So they mm-hmm. may go up on the hill and say, "What do you think about what the, you know, the particular discussion that you all have?"
Mm-hmm.
So that in a sense, I mean, you can tell the same story to news organizations, but they're not going to play it in the same way.
That's true. They'll all put their own little spin on it. But
uh-huh.
I think the way that we can try to keep them consistent is to make them talk to the same person, frankly. So they will certainly ask different kinds of questions, and will write it with their own, with their own sort of sense about what they think is the most interesting aspect of this policy announcement, for example. But the way that we can demonstrate some message discipline and try to be as consistent as possible is by having sort of one focal point of contact.
What happens if you don't like the stories that that the reporters are writing? Like, say, the New York Times is going to do a piece for the next day, mm-hmm. and so their pieces are going to start going up online.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't like a piece. What do you do? So do you dial Peter Baeger?
It's certainly not uncommon to appeal to reporters. Once you've seen, I mean, that is one of the other things that's tougher about that is a double-edged sword, you might say,
uh-huh.
about the internet world, is that a lot of these newspapers that you wouldn't ordinarily read a story until it landed on your doorstep at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
You can now read that story at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and have an opportunity to influence it in the, you know, intervening 15 hours. So it's certainly not uncommon to try to appeal to a reporter to try and add a quote to the story that will give a little bit of a stronger or better point of view for the administration on their story, or to include that perspective a little bit more prominently in their story, not wait till the end to sort of get our response to something.
How successful are you?
It depends on the day. I think it feels like sometimes. Sometimes we're pretty successful in that, sometimes we're not.
Uh-huh.
I will say, and you haven't asked me this question yet, but I do think that the most important lesson that I've learned in the 15 months of doing this job is that you can't do this job unless you have a short memory. The newspaper is going to come out every single day, no matter how mad you are at a reporter.
Uh-huh.
So being unhappy about, if I show up to work tomorrow on Wednesday, still unhappy about last Saturday's story, I'm going to have a tough time doing my job. It's important to be able to get over it quickly. That you can have your differences with a reporter, you can air them, you can make your case for why they should have handled it differently, or why you hope they'll handle it differently in the future. Holding a grudge or continuing to be mad about it days later probably won't just shorten your lifespan, but also will probably make you not very successful at
uh-huh.
your job.
Have you all ever talked about what those relationships are? In a sense, the relationships are not personal relationships. They're institutional relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you represent an ongoing institution, the presidency,
mm-hmm.
and they represent the institution of their news organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationship really is an institutional relationship.
It is an institutional one.
Is that something that's ever mentioned, or is it thought in more personal terms?
I mean, it's given how hard people work and how invested they are in the personal sacrifices that they've made, and I don't mean just our staff. I also mean the reporters who are covering the White House.
Yeah.
It's hard not to invest some personal element in what you're working on. You have to take it personally. Otherwise you wouldn't be getting up at 5 in the morning to read what somebody had written. Or you wouldn't be staying up till midnight to make sure that the story gets done, or making the case to somebody for the fifth time about why they need to see it this way or that way. Or frankly, why a reporter isn't willing to go the extra mile and make the 10th call to ask for a response for something. I know that some of them do that. And it's because they're personally invested that they're good at what they do. In the same way that the best doctors are the ones who are able to walk the fine line of
uh-huh.
being personally invested in their cases and in their patients' well-being, but also to be able to maintain some level of professional detachment so they can make the best possible decisions about what's in their patients' best interests. I think there's an analogy there, that it's important to people wouldn't be as good as they were if they weren't personally invested in their stories or as personally invested in, you know, the issue that they're talking about. But at the same time, there is an element of professionalism that needs to be maintained. And on the part of the reporter, they need to remain unbiased. On the part of of a spokesperson or somebody who's dealing with the media, remembering that the case needs to be about the facts and not about emotion.
Uh-huh.
All of that stuff is tricky to navigate, particularly when you're working in a fast-paced environment where you have news stories that can pop up a story can pop up and a minute later it's on national television. When you're in a circumstance in which you're dealing with people who, when they go on television are talking to 7 million people. And when you are talking about doing this for the most powerful person in the world, whether you're covering that person or talking on their behalf, The stakes are really, really high. But the truth of the matter is, I think that's also why people love it.
Yeah. Do you ever, when you're upset with a reporter that you know they haven't written the story that you all think is the story, that they've had the emphasis on the wrong thing, or have you all stepped back and said, well, maybe we didn't explain it right? That it's not just a question of the reporter, but maybe that we need to do something in how we explain this.
No doubt about it. There are lessons learned every time that something doesn't that something doesn't go the way that we expected it would. There's usually a pretty rational reason for that, and there's usually a way that we could have exerted more control over trying to steer that story in a better direction. Now that's not always true. Sometimes they're just going to be bad stories. There's no doubt that we do spend a decent amount of time thinking about how can we do this a little bit better next time? What can we do to plan this out so that we can have more of the facts right at hand so that we can make a better case for what it is that we're trying to do? Maybe it's we need to deal with a different reporter. Maybe we need to deal with somebody who has a little bit more expertise on this issue the next time that we want to roll it out. So there are lots of different factors that go into.
When would you have those kinds of conversations?
Well, you know, we obviously sort of have these morning meetings and the evening meetings, but it's not uncommon for us to do a sort of an impromptu meeting in the afternoon for us to, with somebody who's been working on a story to say, well, why didn't this work? Why did this come out, why did this come out in a way that's not as helpful as it should be? Or why did this come out worse than it should have? Nobody thought this was going to be a good story. We didn't think it was going to be a horrible story. And so we certainly do spend some time talking about it.
How do you judge success in your operation? How do you judge it? What are the kind of tools that you have to do that? And what are the opportunities where you have to stop and say, were we successful here?
Yeah.
And
what is success? I will say that that one of the things that makes working at the White House so unique is that if you go work for a private sector PR firm, and you want to make the case to your client, that if you work at a PR firm and Acme Inc. Has hired you to work on the rollout, the way that you demonstrate success to them is you send them a bunch of news clips, and the more clips you can send them, the better you have done in helping get their message out. Volume is not an issue at the White House. No matter the president wants to go and roll Easter eggs on his backyard, there are national television outlets clamoring all over themselves to try and get out there and get that on camera. So volume is not the issue, usually. So it's a little harder to measure your success for that reason. I think one way that we measure our success is by watching the nightly news, by watching the network news. It's certainly not as influential as it used to be, but it is a place where you're getting a lot of people who are sitting around the dinner table or tuning in to find out what happened that day, and they do that by watching the network news.
And they listen. Because there are a lot of things, like, say, cable. Somebody can have cable on all day.
Right.
But they may or may not be listening.
Right. I would say that would be one place where we don't use that as a measure of our success. I would also say that there's a keen appreciation for the power of of wire stories, mostly the Associated Press, for the ability of a tight, well-written, focused AP story to seep its way into all sorts of media outlets is powerful. That if you turn on the radio early in the morning, when you hear somebody read the news, they generally are reading from an Associated Press story. When you hear, this is turning into it. Ron Fournier would be very excited to hear me talking about this, but it's true. When you turn on early morning television that a lot of people sort of have on as they're making their oatmeal or, are shaving in the morning, the news they're reading is very closely pulled from AP stories that ran overnight. And so if you really want to influence the way that people are talking about what's happening at the White House, getting a good AP story is a very important part of that. No doubt.
Sometimes an AP story also can be important in what's not taken by others. Mm-hmm. So say, for example, there are a lot of administrations, the Bush people and the Clinton people too. Mm-hmm. If they had some kind of issue that was going to cause them trouble,
right?
That they would work with AP to make sure they got everything out there. And so when it went out, it was used by, let's say it was used by the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And so then the Post would say, well, we don't need to put our own people on it. It's already been done by AP. Mm-hmm. And the version that you would get in AP, like Scott McClellan talked about, the version you get on AP, mm-hmm. through AP, it was going to be a lot more benign. Mm-hmm. Than, it's going to be shorter and tighter than you would have, say, if a Post writer was doing it. Mm-hmm. Do you ever think of those kinds of calculations?
Sometimes that we can we can use the Associated Press as an opportunity to present all of the facts. If we know that there's a bad story uh-huh. coming and we want to sort of present in one place all of the reasons that we think this isn't as bad as people might otherwise, as our critics would say, that if you want to try and find an outlet or a forum for making the case for why something isn't as bad as it might otherwise be perceived to be, the Associated Press can be a good place to do that because they do sort of have this reputation for writing things very straight. Mm-hmm. As we describe it, sort of the, you know, sort of the just the facts,
right.
kind of accounting. And so, if we want to make sure that our facts are included in an evaluation of a policy position, then that's certainly one way to do it.
Mm-hmm. How do you see the new media as being crucial to you? PBS and Jeff Brown did a piece mm-hmm. on PBS recently on the NewsHour mm-hmm. about the operation. Mm-hmm. And all the time, all the people and all the time you all spend
yeah.
in sending out information in a variety of platforms, whether right. it's Twitter, Flickr, or whatever.
Right.
And what benefit do those instruments have for you?
Sure. I think there are two benefits. The first one is that the president ran a campaign focused in which one of his principal promises was obviously he talked a lot about change, right? Change we can believe in was the campaign slogan during the primary. And one of the ways that he wanted to bring change to Washington was he wanted to make government more transparent and accessible to the American people. He felt like he had an obligation, if he were elected president, to make it clear to people what it is that he's doing and why he's doing it. And using tools like the internet and Flickr and Twitter, the blog, we've used YouTube videos extensively, to give people a better sense about what's happening at the White House, to give them opportunities that are, frankly, harder to give to reporters in terms of access to the inner workings of the White House. And so if you go to our website, there is a very robust collection of data that nobody has ever really tried before. And frankly, that's not because nobody else was committed to it, but frankly because the tools didn't exist. To give people a better sense about what's actually happening at the White House and why the president is making the decisions that he's making. So that's part of it. The second thing is that it's not just about putting that information out there, that by using the tools of the internet, we can actually engage people in a discussion about what direction we should take the country. One of the things that they do on our website that I have to admit that I am to this day surprised doesn't get more attention from the White House press corps is there are very senior people in the administration who on a regular basis do a video chat on our website. You'll have people like, I think the best example of this is even in the heat of the health care reform debate, that Nancy Ann DeParle, who is the president's top health care advisor, right, this is the woman who is 24/7 fashioning this reform package of the president's sort of views, on a pretty regular basis did question and answer sessions on our website. That there were reporters who were dying for interviews with Nancy Ann DeParle who didn't really cover the fact that she was taking questions from the American public about health care reform and answering them on the spot, live on television, live on the internet, on a video feed on the internet that was available on our website.
The Bush people did that.
They
had a feature called Ask the White House,
mm-hmm.
and they brought on a variety of people.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was how does the White House work, like they had the chief usher come on, mm-hmm. and they had Bill Allman, the curator, come on, or the florist. But they also had Andy Card came on it, I can't remember whether Karl Rove did it or not, mm-hmm. but most of the major policy people yeah. would do it.
Yeah.
It didn't get a lot of attention either,
right.
but it was an effort to try
exactly.
to get people engaged.
Exactly.
How do you know how engaged people are?
There's some basic measures of how many people logged on to the broadcast
uh-huh.
or how many people ask questions. I mean, we found that particularly when we're talking about an issue like healthcare that's being covered so aggressively by the news media, that we'd literally have tens of thousands of people who'd be logging on to hear what Nancy and DeParle or Kathleen Sebelius or other uh-huh. senior policymakers at the White House were saying about healthcare reform that day.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an opportunity where it's not just about the White House making itself transparent and sort of opening it up, but actually engaging with people about what direction they want the president to take the country, and actually having a conversation, a dialogue with people where they can influence the policy decisions that the administration is making. And that's just sort of mm-hmm. one example of using new tools to
yeah.
not just put information out there, but also to take some information in.
Uh-huh. The internet is giving you lots of opportunities to mm-hmm. get out there, but it also has given a lot of opportunities to critics as well.
Absolutely.
To get out and mm-hmm. Like target people who voted for health care,
mm-hmm.
and some of your allies
mm-hmm.
who think that the Democrats haven't been sufficiently steadfast,
right.
like Ben Nelson and
mm-hmm.
Just take him. Blanche Lincoln would be another one. And MoveOn.org, and have been very critical.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, yes, you've got an opportunity, but it also comes with a lot of hazards.
No doubt about that.
And how do you deal with those? Because things are moving so fast.
Right. I think in this, we had a lot of experience with this during the campaign, too, because
uh-huh.
these are some of the kinds of things we tried to do during the campaign, to really sort of engage people in the political process. And I think that was a key part of the president's success in getting people who'd never really participated in politics or never voted before to get involved in his campaign, is they felt like they were invested. They felt like they were being heard by the campaign. They felt like they could engage in a dialogue with the campaign. And I think the chief lesson that we learned is that there's no sense in trying to control it. That if you go out there and try to dictate to people what are the kinds of things they should write on their blog, or what are the kinds of things that people should do, that if you try to dictate to them, the president talks about this as try to apply a top-down approach, that you're not going to be very successful. But that if you try to harness it in a different way, that if you put yourself out there, that if you try to engage people and give them a sense about what you're trying to achieve in that discussion, that you can foster an environment in which people feel empowered. They feel like it's their opportunity to really get involved. And sure, in some cases they may get involved in a way that if you had your choice, you wouldn't ask them to, right? That you wouldn't want
mm-hmm.
them to, frankly, to be even critical of the administration. There are plenty of people who...
Yeah.
who go out there who are supportive of the president, but then will use the internet to criticize him or to question why he's approached a certain policy.
Your left.
One policy over another. Yeah, sure,
yeah,
sure. This actually came up, there's actually a good anecdote of this. During the campaign, there was I'm trying to think of the exact piece of legislation, but there was a piece of national security legislation that was related to the power of the government to, I'm trying to think about what exactly this was. It had something to do with the power of the government basically to conduct surveillance operations about people who were in this country. And the president, the then candidate, Senator Obama, had adopted a position that some of our supporters on the left were pretty unhappy about. And so what they did was you had the ability on our campaign website to create your own, basically your own version of a Facebook page, right? We called it your, mybarackobama.com, where you could go on and you could say, I'm gonna create a Law Students for Obama page. And I'd sort of organize people and we'd make phone calls and we'd do this. So it'd be, You know, you could create a page and organize people through that website for your effort. Well, a group of people who were supporters of our campaign, who were active in our campaign, actually started a website to criticize the then candidate, Obama, on his own campaign page for taking the position that he did on this piece of legislation. So this is a great example of people using the tools provided to them by the campaign to criticize the candidate. But again, this was an opportunity for the president to, and what the president did was they basically sort of had this long-running blog about why this was such a horrible idea, and about why the candidate was taking such a bad position. That what we did was we actually had the president, again, the senator at that time, the candidate, post in his own words an explanation to that website why he'd adopted the position that he took. It was a very well-reasoned answer. I think it was a persuasive answer. I'm not confident it necessarily changed the minds of that many people who were involved in that group, that by the end of it, they were very successful in organizing. They had thousands and thousands of people who joined this website. I'm not sure that many people's minds were changed about this particular issue, but because the president chose to engage them in this forum, to sort of give them the tools to organize in this way, and sort of showed them the respect to engage in a dialogue and a debate with them about why he felt the way that he did on this issue, that he won more supporters that by disagreeing with them in that forum than I think anybody ever thought you would have. But it's a new approach to doing this, right? We're not trying to, it would have been tempting to go and just try to shut down the website, right? There are network administrators, it's our website. It would have been easy to do that, but the president chose to engage them. He didn't try to control them and tell them what to do with these tools. He gave them the power to organize in this way around an issue that they felt strongly about, and have a discussion and dialogue and a debate with them about the pros and cons, about the merits of that issue. And I think that is a good example of the president sort of winning over a lot of supporters, or you know, winning over a lot of voters because of his willingness to engage with them and to, you know, through these new tools.
Okay. Let's take some questions.
Let's do it.
Yeah. And Towson?
You guys still awake out there?
Yeah, this is hopping back a bit, but we were talking earlier about steering messages, and in terms of that, I was wondering, do you find that the general public is looking for sort of like a Hollywood presidency? Do you put like any sort of theatrics into steering your message, and do you find like a lot of comparisons like someone in like the West Wing or Hollywood movies and that sort of stuff? Like, what sort of theatrics do you put into steering your message, basically, is what I'm asking.
Sure. No, that's it's a very good question. I think one thing that we've learned that's really important is I do think that it's important for us to be authentic. That trying to overreach in terms of fashioning a message or overreaching in terms of trying to create an artificial platform from which the president can make a grand announcement, that if you try to overdo that, that there are real perils to that. I mean, the mission accomplished banner from the previous administration is the hallmark example of that, of somebody really sort of overreaching in terms of trying to create a setting in which to make a dramatic announcement or to try to elevate the significance of an announcement or of the president himself. So I would say that we are cautious and that we're constantly asking ourselves, is this an authentic environment? Is this an appropriate, authentic setting in which to put the President of the United States? At the same time, it's also important to respect the office and the significance of the office. So we are careful about making sure that the President appears with flags and things, and we're conscious of the kinds of people who will stand with the President when he's making an announcement, those sorts of things. So we're certainly conscious of and aware of the setting and sort of the stagecraft that goes into a public presidential appearance. I would say the one element that we probably work the hardest at is, given the sort of state of the economy, and given the very real pocketbook concerns that so many people have, it's important that we don't fall into the trap of repeatedly showing the president on an elevated stage by himself, almost literally physically removed from the people that that inhabit this country, the people that are voting for him, the people who will be most directly affected by the policies that he's advocating for. So we do make a conscious effort to try and put the president in settings where he'll actually talk to quote-unquote real people, that he will go and do a tour of a factory when he's visiting someplace outside the White House, that we will try to regularly bring people to the White House to participate in White House events. Over the course of this healthcare reform debate, the president did several events with doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals so that he could have the chance to interact with them, and that he could also, frankly, demonstrate to the American people that he was listening to these healthcare professionals as he was making decisions about what should be included in the healthcare reform package. That those sorts of symbols and those sorts of images are critical to delivering a clear message or the clear message of the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Do you all have, somebody have a question?
Sure.
I was hoping you could speak a little bit about how President Obama's, obviously well-known oratory skills sort of affects your job and whether that makes it easier or more difficult, because in some sense it might seem it's easier because he can explain things to the country better, what have you, but sometimes it makes it maybe more difficult for your office when you're charged with explaining something that maybe the people would rather have the president speak on directly.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. That is something that we, why don't I say it this way? This is something that the media routinely second guesses the administration on. It's not uncommon for after the president's done a high profile interview or done a, last year he did a succession of news conferences, sort of back to back to back. I think he did four or five of, within the space of 4 or 5 months, that that there were a lot of pundits and observers who were questioning whether the president was overexposed. He's on TV too much, and that people were going to get sick of seeing him on TV, and they were going to change the channel, and that was going to affect their view of him. That they were just tired of seeing his face on television. And then, the president will go, several weeks without doing a news conference or a public appearance, and people will say, why is the president hiding? Why won't he talk to the American people? Doesn't he have an obligation as the leader of this country to communicate with the American people about what he's thinking and what he's doing and why he's making the decisions that he makes? So there's a lot of second guessing that goes on about this. But you're right, that the president is, both because of the position that he holds, but also because of the natural skills that that person has, is by far the best advocate that this administration has for the policies that we want to implement. And that means the president has a lot of responsibilities, that when we want to make the big sell, that we want to roll something out that's significant, that if we want to make the case, that the president has to be personally involved. And that requires a lot of time and effort and preparation and practice. It's also, without a doubt, one of the keys to his success. It's his ability to make the case to the American public personally about what he's doing and why what he's doing is the right thing for the people in this country. The other factor is we have to sort of make some decisions about how often to do it and when to do it and what setting will be most effective. Is it more effective for us to, and Martha, you and I have talked about this a lot, is it more effective for the president to make this case in the context of an interview, a sit-down interview on a Sunday show? Or is it more effective for the president to go out and do a news conference in front of the assembled media to answer questions about all these things? Is it more effective for him to go to the House Republican caucus and make this case and answer questions from Republicans? Is it more effective for him to do a speech, to give a primetime speech? You may remember that when the president announced his decision about the way forward in Afghanistan, and sort of dealing with the problems posed by Afghanistan and Pakistan, the president didn't do it in an interview. He didn't do it in a news conference. He actually did it in the form of a primetime speech that was carried live on television. He didn't do it from the Oval Office. He didn't do it from the Rose Garden. He actually flew to to West Point in New York and delivered it in front of a large room full of soldiers, many of whom were getting ready to graduate from West Point and were going to be serving in Afghanistan. And so the president felt the responsibility to make that case and explain that decision directly to, frankly, the people who would be impacted by it most, the people who are going to go and put themselves in harm's way on the front lines. So there are lots of different ways for us to put the president in the context of making this case. and it certainly is an important part of that decision.
Who's in the room when you're coming up with ideas of what things that the president should be involved in and what things he shouldn't? Mm-hmm. Who participates in those discussions? And when does he get involved?
The way that he generally likes to work is that he generally wants a specific recommendation from his staff and somebody that he trusts. So generally it's somebody like Robert Gibbs or Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, or David Axelrod, his senior advisor. Dan Pfeiffer, the communications director, on occasion will participate in the discussions directly with the president, making the case to the president about why this decision is important for him to announce and why the context in which his staff is recommending that his staff is recommending is the best context from which to make that argument. Mm-hmm. But in terms of sort of the staff talking about it, I mean, it's generally members of our communication staff and members of our press staff who will get together. And Robert Gibbs has the biggest office, so we generally do it in his office.
Yeah.
And we'll have a discussion in a staff level discussion and debate about what makes the most sense. And then a smaller group of the president's senior staff will go and make that case to the president.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's a factor for you all is as well in your coverage, say on speeches, is that the president has drawn much more interest than was true certainly of President Bush. So cable there is willing to carry most of the speeches that the president gives.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a risk of overexposure that perhaps President Bush didn't have. Mm-hmm. When you look, as we've talked about, the number, if you could add together all the addresses and remarks, big and small, that Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama have made, it's almost the same.
Mm-hmm.
In the first year of each of their presidencies, the difference is less than 50 mm-hmm. of the number of speeches they've given. But the amount of airtime they've got was enormously different. So mm-hmm. President Obama has gotten 4 nighttime news conferences, which none of his predecessors had in mm-hmm. In the time that he had it, which was in his first 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So is that a factor that you think about as well?
It is a little bit, but I would say that that we don't spend a lot of time worrying about the president being overexposed. And I think the reason for that is, principally, I think there are two reasons. One is, I think that there's an expectation that the American people will see a lot of their president, that people do want to see a lot of him, that they do want to see him out there. They do want to hear him explain why he supports one position or another. But I think the second one is that particularly early last year at this time, this president was dealing with a range of issues that were on a historic scale. That we had an economic downturn, the biggest economic downturn since the Great Depression. That hundreds of thousands of people were losing their jobs each month. And we were fighting two wars. That our military was overstretched, and the president had promised to withdraw our troops from Iraq. That it was clear that we weren't being as successful in Afghanistan and in Pakistan as we would like to be, and then and that was because we had dedicated the resources that we needed to win that fight. The president had talked a lot in the campaign about trying to change that dynamic, about getting our combat troops out of Iraq and investing in resources that we need in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So these are weighty issues that the president was grappling mm-hmm. with. You know, I also a year ago at this time, the president was sort of weighing the decision about what to do about the two of the largest auto companies in America, that they were at the risk of outright failure, and what was the president going to do with hundreds of thousands of more jobs in the balance that were invested in this sector, not to mention the billions of taxpayer dollars that had already been on the hook for these auto companies. So the president was dealing with some pretty weighty issues, and I think that the American public wanted to hear from him about what he was mm-hmm. doing about it. So, I do think that, the president probably was on television and was being seen on television by a lot more people than his predecessors, but I also think that given the nature of the challenges that he was confronting, people were comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. Towson, question?
Yes, hi. I was wondering, how does the White House decide which critics to respond to?
I'll accept your premise that there are critics of the White House. I'm just being sarcastic if that doesn't translate on video conference. It's an excellent question, because the truth of the matter is there are critics of the White House, and if we wanted to, we could spend every minute of every day trying to answer those critics, some of which are based in fact and some of which aren't. I think we make that decision weighing a couple of factors. Certainly the impact or the significance of the outlet in which the criticism is being lodged. If it's, if the guy who moderates bobspoliticaljournal.com, we probably aren't going to waste a lot of time and energy arguing with somebody who doesn't have much of an audience. If the same criticism is being leveled by David Gregory on Meet the Press on Sunday, then that's something that's probably going to get our attention, and it's something that is going to that's something that we will respond to, that we will react to. The degree to which the criticisms are based in fact also weighs pretty heavily on the decision that we make in terms of how to respond to it. Because of the internet, there are a lot of people out there making charges that just aren't true. The most commonly cited example of this are the people who were on the internet warning people that if healthcare reform passed, they were going to have to go in front and testify in front of a death panel. That was not true, even though there are some pretty important, high-profile people making that charge. We didn't spend a lot of time responding to that charge other than to say that it wasn't true. But I wouldn't say that we necessarily dedicated a lot of resources to trying to put people on TV or writing op-eds to make sure that people knew it wasn't true. We just said it wasn't true. The president said that many times, and people were asked about it many times, but other than saying it wasn't true, we didn't spend a whole lot of time developing a strategy to counter some of those myths.
What about Fox? You all had a high-profile mm-hmm. battle with Fox. Mm-hmm. How was that decision made to engage in the battle, and what did you get out of it?
Well, I'll say this about Fox: is there are people who. Let me say it this way. The executives at Fox themselves draw a clear distinction between what they view as news programming at Fox and what they view as opinion programming at Fox. What we have chosen to do is to engage directly with the people who are responsible for the news programming at Fox. There is a fleet of White House reporters and producers mm-hmm. Who work for Fox, who are very dedicated and diligent, and I think do a good job. Doesn't mean I like every single story that they put on there, but folks like Major Garrett and Wendell Goler, I think work very, very hard to understand what's happening at the White House and understand and have the facts about why the president is making the decisions that he's making. And I think they report that faithfully on the network. I think that there are people who have an axe to grind, who have hour-long programs on Fox, and are harsh critics of this administration, that we don't spend a whole lot of time trying to answer. I think that's that. Uh-huh. I think that what we've basically did, our strategy for dealing with Fox is to engage directly with the people who are responsible for the news program. And we saw a month ago the president did an interview with Brett Baer, mm-hmm. the evening news anchor at Fox uh-huh. News, to have a discussion about what was included in the healthcare reform bill.
In leading up to the interview, what were you thinking of as the reason to do it and what you were getting out of it. And then afterwards, how did you feel about the interview?
Mm-hmm. The thinking was that one, Fox obviously has a huge audience. They're the most watched cable news network on television. So there are a lot of people who are watching that programming that we wanted to be able to reach. The vast majority of those people probably don't agree with the president on health care reform and don't probably agree with him on much else. But again, there is a steadfast belief that starts with the president and it permeates its way through the staff that making the case for the decisions that you're making by explaining to the American people why they are the right decisions, that just the act, the process of going of doing that is important, is a responsibility of a public official, and will engender goodwill from the American people regardless of whether they agree with you or not. If they mm-hmm. think that you are making an honest effort to make the right decision and are making this decision for all the right reasons, the people are going to respect you. Mm-hmm. And so even if the president went on there and didn't necessarily change a lot of minds, he went on there with the expectation that he'd be able to win the respect of some of the people who are watching. In terms of the way that it turned out, I think that we were probably successful in that. Mm-hmm. I think the president, in terms of the actual interview himself, I think was, during the interview, frankly, was visibly frustrated that he mm-hmm. felt like he was getting interrupted mm-hmm. And wasn't sort of given the latitude that he wanted to complete his thoughts and to articulate his point of view. But he also acknowledged at the end of that interview that it was Brett's responsibility to try to ask as many questions as he can. And in order to do that, he felt like he had to interrupt the president a couple of times to do that. So mm-hmm. I think that the president was successful in being able to go on there and basically make the case in front of a pretty skeptical audience about why health care reform was the right avenue, was the mm-hmm. right thing to pursue.
Is there a question here? Yeah,
sure.
Well, the 2010 midterms are officially 7 months away now. Yeah. So what role do you see the White House Communications Department, specifically, role in, ensuring a Democratic, not necessarily gaining more seats, but stop the supposedly bleeding that could happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, the historical context here is important because I was just looking at this the other day, actually. I think that there are two times in the last 40 or 50 years in which a first-term president has not lost seats for his party in the Congress. So all the historical trends indicate that Democrats are likely to lose seats in this election. And that is a pretty good indication that the ability of the White House to influence the outcome of those elections is pretty limited. There are some things that the president can do and will do, frankly, has already done a little bit and will continue to do. And I think the most important one is to make the case to his supporters, the president's supporters, who less than 2 years ago turned out in record numbers to support his campaign to change Washington, to make the case, to travel across the country and make the case why the person who's standing on stage next to him, their elected member of Congress, is helping the president bring the change that the president promised to Washington, D.C. And that makes him a valuable asset, that there are a lot of people who will listen to that, who will listen to the president, who will be open to the president making the case about why this person should be reelected. And that's a pretty valuable role the president can play. But as I was mentioning before, the president, if there are members of Congress who are expecting the president to fly around the country and tell people who to vote for, and that all those people are just going to follow what he says like lemmings, that's not going to happen. But what the president can do is go out there and make a persuasive case about how one particular member of Congress is helping him bring change to Washington and something that he'll do. The president obviously can be helpful in raising money, and the president will just spend some time doing that. To make sure that Democrats have the resources that they need to make the case about why they should be, either should be elected or reelected. I think the last thing that the president can do is the president can have some influence over the atmospherics of the election, that the president can set the agenda, that the president can influence how people are talking about that agenda, about sort of the pros and cons of the agenda that, that Democrats will be running on a very national level. And those campaigns will have to localize it and explain why the, sort of this national discussion about a particular policy area is important to the people in their community. But how the president's success in influencing sort of the national atmospherics of the political environment will influence and have an impact on the success of local Democrats to make the case about why they should be reelected.
Towson?
I know since the beginning there have been a lot of rumors going around about the president, like I know some people were saying that he was a communist, or some people were saying he wasn't born in the U.S., stuff like that. What kinds of things do you guys do to, or how do you go about responding to that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. This is actually an issue that was much more difficult for us to confront in the campaign, in the context of the campaign, than it is now. We didn't get a chance to talk about this very much, but my first job with then-Senator Obama was as his communications director during the Iowa caucuses in Iowa. And there were emails that were flying all over the internet very aggressively to caucus goers that were questioning the president's loyalty to the country, that suggested that he was a Muslim, that raised questions about where he was born, suggesting that he was not born in the United States, and question, you know, outright questioning his patriotism. And there was a very central strategic question to dealing with those charges, because one is, by responding to them, you elevate those charges,
right?
That if you have this underground campaign that's difficult to measure, you can't really tell how many people got an email. It was difficult to know, to sort of calibrate our response in such a way that we were answering the questions of people who'd received that email and setting the record straight. The president was, in fact, born in Hawaii and was an American, that he was not a Muslim, but that he was a Christian, that he was loyal to the country and was proud to salute the flag and had a grandfather that served in World War II and all these other things. And we basically confronted those questions and those charges in two ways. One is, this has been written about quite a bit, that the president had a had an incredible field operation in Iowa and other places across the country, but particularly in Iowa. A small state like Iowa, that by the end of the caucuses, I think that we had like 60 campaign offices opened all across the state. And we had thousands and thousands of volunteers who were supported by hundreds of field organizers who were working on the ground to mobilize this volunteer army. So we had a pretty loud megaphone that we could equip all these volunteers and these field organizers with the facts about the president's background and the president's beliefs. And that was a pretty effective way of dealing with that, that literally person to person, that we could set the record straight. And the truth of the matter is, when you get an anonymous email, that can have I think a lot of people, it seemed pretty believable. And the only way to try to counteract something like that, because an email is personal, right? You get it on your personal account. It feels like a very personal communication. So that in order to confront that thing at a similarly personal level, we need neighbors talking to neighbors about the email they received. It says, hey, I don't know if you know, that somebody would, when they walk into the grocery store, or they walk into church on Sunday morning, or they are... sitting at their cubicles, sort of talking about politics. That equipping people with the facts was a very, very effective way that we could sort of rebut those charges using our grassroots network of people. The second thing that we did was we actually created a campaign, a section of our campaign website that was dedicated exclusively to knocking down crazy rumors. That we unveiled a website called fightthesmears.com that basically was a clearinghouse for people who heard crazy things about the candidate for president who could go to our website and learn the facts. So, for example, we included on the Fight the Smears website a digital scanned copy of the president's birth certificate that demonstrated that the president of the United States was, in fact, or that then a candidate for president of the United States was, in fact, born in Hawaii, born in the United States, and was eligible to serve the presidency. There was also another rumor that the president refused to put his hand over his heart during the Pledge of Allegiance, that he didn't think that that was important, that he didn't think the flag was an important symbol of our country, and that he thought that that was not an important sign of patriotism. So we actually went on YouTube and pulled C-SPAN clips of the president leading the Pledge of Allegiance at the opening of sessions of the United States Senate. Mm-hmm. And he'd sort of take turns, you know, opening the Senate session, so he would lead the Pledge of Allegiance. So he'd be on camera with his hand over his heart reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. And so we basically compiled all those YouTube clips and said, here's television footage of the president repeatedly putting his hand over his heart and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. So we're able to use the internet in that way to try to respond to a lot of those things. And the truth of the matter is, the people who continue to believe that who continue to question the president's patriotism, and the people who continue to believe that the president or doubt that the president was born in this country, are people whose minds are never going to be changed about that. Mm-hmm. And so those resources are still available online, but we don't spend a lot of time trying to convince people that the president was born in Hawaii.
Well, we've gone through our time, and
excellent.
I want to thank you very much.
Of course, I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah.
So thanks for the question.